This episode of The Organist contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
InvincibleDad.com, MagnificentWebsite.com, BrilliantRealtor.com, WonderfulDentist.com, HamAndGreenEggs.com, ElderlyBadass.com, ExpletiveWorld.com, CussWorld.com, WorldsBestHotDog.com, SpecialGrandson.com, CoolGrandson.com.
From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist. I'm Andrew Leland.
CocaineGalaxy.com, CocaineUniverse.com, Cocainery.com, BadassPerson.com, DecentEmployer.com.
This is Brian McMullen reading from his project StillNot.coms, an indirectory.
ChessBadass.com, GrammarBadass.com, BadassPolitician.com, BadassCorporation.com, Badass.
StillNot.coms is an ever-changing catalog of URLs, unregistered .com domain names. When you type these URLs into your web browser, nothing happens. Not even a parked website with that stock photo of the blonde college student wearing a backpack who's offering to sell you the domain name. These are totally unregistered. Server could not be found.
BadGrandchild.com, TeenSurgeon.com, TeenSurgery.com, FunSurgeon.com.
The latest version of the project, which Brian has shared with The Organist, contains exactly 1,000 URLs.
DecentLover.com, SuperEasyJobs.com.
Brian began the project in 2000, when the dot-com bubble was nearly at its peak. That year, if you can remember, 16 Super Bowl commercials advertised companies whose names ended in .com. It was everywhere.
BoneGhost.com.
Since then, of course, the internet has massively expanded into our daily lives, even as URLs seem to consolidate into a few platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Amazon, that host the content that might have previously appeared on any number of individual websites. These days, the internet resembles, to me, the map that Borges imagined, one that's as large as the land it describes. A map of the empire, Borges wrote, whose size was that of the empire, and which coincided point for point with it. Today's internet offers the promise that anything I might think of, any geographical point on Earth or any business or any human being, is somehow accessible and locatable online, spread out across an internet the size of the Earth itself.
Here's StillNot.com's numbers 101 through 200. YuckyDude.com, VeryHappyMan.com, StomachPorn.com, YuckyPorn.com, BlurryVideos.com.
What I like about Brian's StillNot.com's project is that it pushes back against the relentless cataloging that the internet constantly performs, indexing every meal, every song, every day, and finds the holes in that map, things that haven't been thought of yet, uncharted waters, sites that still haven't been bought or sold, claimed or marketed.
Sextuplebogey.com, Septuplebogey.com.
Insane things that only Brian would think of.
Meatwoman.com, Foodbinger.com, Foodiebinge.com, Heckhole.com, GoshDarnYou.com.
I think there's real generosity in Brian's gesture. As of this recording, all 1,000 URLs remain available for purchase at the entry-level price of domain registration. If you're interested, you're free to stake out this territory for yourself.
HairyPerson.com, HairyChild.com, BaldPerson.com.
We'll hear more selections from the hundreds of remaining unregistered URLs that Brian collected later in the show. But first, let's hear about another project that considers the expressive potential of the internet. It's a common enough scene in New York City, the one you won't see unless you actually peer through someone's bedroom window. A young novelist sits in his basement apartment, a cigarette dangling from his lips, banging away at his laptop. It's late in the day in the fall of 2015. The novelist has been at it, with few interruptions, for nearly 5 hours.
Just come up on the fucking screen,
He's frustrated. He might be irritated about some mechanical aspect of his novel, a structural issue or some character or plot problem. And he is preoccupied with these narrative challenges. But right now, his main difficulty is more technical. He can't believe how slow his computer is being.
Because this computer's a piece of shit, but also there are a lot of people on right now. And so I press a button, and I press a key, and it only materializes as a letter like 4 seconds later.
The novelist's computer is slow because he's writing on the internet.
I'm Joshua Cohen, and I'm a writer, and I am in Red Hook, Brooklyn, New York.
I don't mean that he's writing on a Google Doc or a blog post. He's writing his novel on a website where every word he types in his basement apartment is viewed instantly by thousands of people who are all watching him do it from the same webpage, like a sort of literary Facebook Live, a bespoke online word processor with a webcam hooked up to it.
It's live writing, not live typing, because that would be boring. So every day, Monday through Friday, from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., I work on it.
For a writer like Cohen, who can labor over a sentence for months, the idea of letting anyone on the internet watch him bang out a first draft in real time is a humbling, potentially humiliating experience. And the internet, being the internet, doesn't disappoint. As Cohen writes, a chat room on the margin of the screen fills with commenters, alternately cheering him on and posting Reddit-grade inflammatory hate speech. It's still a few minutes until 6 o'clock, when he's scheduled to stop work on his second day of writing. There's a knock at the door, which Josh leaves unlocked so he doesn't have to get up when he has visitors.
Hey, come in. Come on in, man. It's a disaster in here.
What's going on?
It's down to the fucking wire.
Sam Levine enters the apartment.
This is what it looks like every day, man.
Sam is the artist and programmer who built the interface that Josh has just been cursing at.
I was just complaining about your genius work.
They sit in silence as Cohen scrolls through his day's output, adding and deleting sentences, as thousands of people watch and talk in the live chat that runs along the margin.
Can I grab a beer?
Yeah. Do it.
I'm Sam Levine, and I made a website that Josh uses to type his real-time novel.
Sam isn't just a coder who implemented this project. He's an artist in his own right, part of the internet art collective called Useless Press. And this project is a collaboration between Sam and Josh. The user's experience of reading the novel, as well as Josh's experience of writing it, are both carefully constructed by Sam.
We really want the website and the writing to be like kind of like the same thing, you know? So this isn't like, the idea is not that then like some other writer could come in and do the same thing on the platform that I made. The idea is that like this website and the novel are part of the same object, right? So all the features of the website are like deeply connected to what the content of the novel is.
The novel that Josh is writing is called Pickwick, spelled in all caps without any vowels, in the tradition of websites and apps that tend to drop their vowels as a sign of their Web 2.0-ness. Think Grindr, Tumblr, Pickwick.
It's, you know, loosely thematically based on Charles Dickens' The Pickwick Papers, which is, you know, one of the, you know, most famous, if not the most famous and most successful early serialized novel. And that's the story of the Pickwick Club, which is a group of British gentlemen who sort of go terracing around the countryside in pursuit of knowledge. And they end up really getting drunk and getting into fights with high hilarity along the way. But in my rewrite, Pickwick seems to have become a military contractor that extraordinarily renders people and tortures them.
This idea, to recast Dickens's character as a military contractor who tortures people, came out of the notion of Pickwick itself. That is, the idea of writing a novel live on the internet with an unmoderated, anonymous, and overcrowded chat room running down the edge. Sam draws a direct line between those anonymous commenters and the torture Josh writes about in Pickwick.
The story that Josh is writing is about someone being like interrogated and tortured, basically. And the people in the chat room are, they're kind of like occupying that role, essentially. They're like torturing Josh in a way, and possibly each other. But also, like, there's a lot of really, like, hateful stuff in there, but there's also, like, a lot of really interesting things and a lot of really funny things that kind of all go together. You know, it's, like, a completely unmoderated chat room, which is, like, increasingly rare today online and maybe almost non-existent. My favorite, like, things that I saw in it yesterday was someone said that it reminded them of, like, the internet from the 90s. it's sort of like exactly like the goal of one of the things that we're trying to do is create these things that like recall like a sort of different time in the internet, you know, where more things were possible and things were done just for the sake of doing them.
He looks stressed.
Let's stress him even more.
Pickwick's chat room is maybe what you'd expect it to be if you spent any time in the unmoderated corners of the internet.
Maybe the next paragraph can include a flight to France, Joshua, to speak to the ambassador.
There are commenters who sound like they're from literary Brooklyn, making clever, insidery jokes about Josh Cohen and his writing and his lifestyle.
How many of the 74 people in this chat read him?
Are you going to write a think piece about this experience? About the novel and the internet age? I still think he should try to create a female character with a shred of interior thought.
And there are wide-eyed tourist commenters who chat earnestly, cheering Josh on or marvel at the novelty and excitement of being a part of the first novel written live on the internet.
I made $200 working from home today.
And then, sadly, and maybe inevitably, there's a lot of really, really crude material. Racist, sexist, xenophobic comments. Some directed at Josh, some just sprayed at random.
I mean, if I'm trying to write somewhat of a coherent episode in a period of 5 hours, I can't be looking at, you know, multicolor scrolling hate speech.
At the end of each writing day, Josh gets a report, automatically generated by the website, that includes a log of all the comments. But while he's writing, Josh keeps the chat window pushed off the screen, mostly out of view. At the end of the first day, he read through the insane porridge of that day's chat logs. Then the next morning, the novel suddenly turned to the subject of torture.
And I'm not making a moral equivalency between commentators online and torturers. I'm making, you know, a metaphor. And the metaphor is essentially, you know, one where one can act with complete impunity and not really care or be held responsible for damage.
This metaphor points to the ways in which Josh, the writer, and the anonymous commentators, his readers, are in inverse roles. Josh has total transparency, is fully accountable from 1 to 6 p.m. every day this week, with every typo and ill-advised or hastily constructed sentence hanging out there until he decides to delete or refine it. And this other group has zero transparency, with the freedom to post whatever they please with no fear of recrimination. And it's interesting to see the disparity between the two kinds of writing these two positions generate, the kind of language that gets produced with total transparency and what people say when they're given total anonymity. In this way, the old-fashioned serialized novel actually becomes a pretty good venue to explore these questions of what you might call the fictions of the internet, a little over a year before fake news became a commonplace.
Is the narrator the author? You know, are they telling me the truth? What sort of reality hunger do we have here? I mean, no one has reality hunger more than a torturer who's convinced, you know, himself or herself that the person they're torturing has information that would stop an imminent attack. And to me, fiction does have some of these aspects of how far can you push on a fictional text, you know, to see where the truth is before you've lost the meaning of reading.
A few months earlier, Cohen had published his fourth novel, Book of Numbers, a massively ambitious and deeply ambivalent novel about the internet.
You know, I mean, I wrote a book about the internet. It was, you know, it was certainly the product of a number of anxieties. And I decided that, you know, let's challenge these anxieties. Let's not become complacent I don't want to be complacent in my distaste, and I don't want to be complacent in my dismay, and I don't want to be a pessimist or a declinist. So this was willed optimism.
One of the many ways that the internet makes life difficult for a novelist is how it throws together high and low forms of writing. What can a writer do when their job description demands meticulous attention to language, but every day they're forced to confront thousands of emails, text messages, bloggy essays, and content that most writers have to produce to make a living and participate in contemporary culture?
Well, obviously, I have some anxiety about this. I mean, you know, born before the internet, born into a culture of the book, born into a family that valued books, and taking books sort of as the model for all thought in the sense of, you know, worrying, fussing over its fixities, you know, having a perfectionism, having a notion that it's never right, it's never at its depth, it's never been contoured in the most perfect way. You know, the idea and the expression coming at the same time, being inseparable. It's a constant search for this elusive perfection. And once you see the world that surrounds it, that enfolds that notion of perfection, it becomes harder to sustain. First of all, there's the rate of the production that the internet sort of demands, right? This gaping maw just wants content. And we throw content down it. We send messages to each other and the messages built up. You know, the rate of communication constantly escalates. And as it does, the notion of the slow, painstaking culture worker not only becomes economically devalued, because it's always been economically devalued, becomes more economically devalued, but it also becomes culturally devalued. It's seen as something that's pretentious. It's seen as something that is superior, snobbish. And I don't like those characterizations, but I also don't want to feel so distant and so split in myself. So this was maybe an attempt to integrate aspects of my life or destroy all of them. We'll see what happens.
It's almost 6 p.m. and at this point, Josh and Sam are just running down the clock.
Right. 35 seconds.
What are you going to do? Last 35 seconds.
Erase all of it.
Just delete it all.
Just fuck them all.
Josh seems physically exhausted from his 5-hour performance. Finally, the clock hits 6.
All right.
Cool. Congratulations.
Holy shit, man.
Another day.
Another day. Let me turn this thing off. See just what the last comment is here, because I always love that. Oh, nice.
Is it anti-Semitic?
Well, a lot of it is.
Yeah.
There's a wide gulf between the improvised, unrevised performance of this project and the painstaking labor that goes into Josh's real novels. The years of writing and revision that result in books like Moving Kings, his latest, which came out earlier this summer. Pickwick is a different animal.
And I should also say I don't really believe this is a novel. It's certainly not a good novel, but it's not even a bad novel. It's whatever a person can do, whatever I can do, sitting 5 hours a day, 5 days a week with a camera on me, and trying to make sense out of a mess, and a large part of the mess, you know, being given to me by user data and by comments. I do sit and write for, you know, books that are real books. I do sit and write for 5 hours a day, for more than 5 hours a day, but I don't emerge from it feeling so wasted. I mean, this is an experiment in anxiety.
My favorite feature that Sam built into the website is the hearts. Whenever a reader clicks on a word that Josh has typed, little hearts blossom out of their mouse pointer onto the word, on their screen and on Josh's. And I love to imagine the novelist hammering out his book, filled to the brim with anxieties, writing through a bouquet of hearts blossoming out of his sentences, a cavalcade of networked likes. Unlike the chat room or the video feed, this feature is one that Josh can't turn off or hide on his screen. But I wondered if it also wasn't the one feature that's in some way an improvement on the old-fashioned disconnected word processor or typewriter.
That is one thing I see. I see a lot of hearts, yes.
How's that?
Distracting.
Yeah, you don't like it?
I mean, I would prefer to write on a surface that wasn't blooming with hearts, yes. If given the choice.
Useless Press took down the Pickwick website at the end of the week. There's no way for you to read it. But you can read Cohen's new novel, which was composed without hearts blooming on the author's screen as he wrote, or an insane chat room running down the margins. It's called Moving Kings, and you can find it in bookstores now. It's also available as an ebook. After the break, unreliable narrators and rap music, slow closed toilets, and the opportunity to register kittenlawyer.com. We'll be right back.
KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Hey, yo, yo, y'all can't stand right here. In his right hand was your man's worst nightmare. Loud enough to burst his right eardrum close range. The game is not only dangerous, but it's most strange. I sell rhymes like dimes. The one who mostly keeps...
So after more than a year hiatus, The Believer magazine is back in print. And the new issue is out this month. It's the music issue, which The Believer does every year. And this is the first issue of The Believer that's coming out since its move to Las Vegas. The Believer is no longer being published out of San Francisco. Now it's being published at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And it's part of something called the Black Mountain Institute, which is this literary nonprofit that does really great work. And we're really excited that The Believer is there now. Other than that, the magazine is identical. The new issue has the same mix of essays and interviews that it always has. This issue has columns that have been going on for years from Nick Hornby, Daniel Handler. It's got essays about Christian gospel music in Northern India and Afrofuturism and the musicality of the female orgasm, and interviews with really diverse range of musicians, from the new age musician Enya to the bass guitar legend Mike Watt, Lil B, Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, and then, as usual, a bunch of smaller, weirder, miscellaneous things that are no less awesome for their miscellaneousness, including a set of reviews. The Believer's reviews section is really unusual. Most magazines' review sections are, you know, between 3 and 4 straightforward reviews of recent books or albums or movies. The Believer approaches reviews differently. The editor is this guy, Daniel Levin Becker, who incidentally is the youngest member of the French avant-garde literary cabal, the Oulipo. But that's neither here nor there. But he, with his fellow editors, he'll select these really idiosyncratic themes, and the reviews won't just be about books or movies. It'll be about sometimes a single sentence in a book, or, you know, a single passage in a song, a single scene in a movie. And in the new issue of The Believer that's out this month, the music issue, one of the contributing editors of this podcast is Naila Orr, and she has a piece in the reviews section. And I have her here now to talk to me about what her piece is. Hi, Naila.
Hi, Andrew.
So I was just describing how the review section of The Believer works and how it has a theme every time. What's the theme of the review section in this issue of The Believer?
The theme of the review section of this issue of The Believer is unreliable songwriters.
So did Daniel Levin Becker say to you, "We're doing unreliable songwriters, what you got?" Or how did it work?
Actually, it was like kismet. Honestly, he didn't pitch me on the subject. I was just listening to a lot of one particular rapper in 2015, and that rapper was MF Doom. And there was a record store day release of one of his earlier albums called Black Bastards, when he was in this group called KMD, which is short for Cause and Mass Damage. So there was a record store release day of this album that he originally put out in 1994. And so I felt like the themes that were coming up or arising in Black Bastards like fit neatly with this series of unreliable incidents he had back in the mid-2000s.
So what are these incidents that you're describing?
So the incidents, are called, by some factions of Doom fandom, they're called Doomposters, and by others are called MF Dupes. And basically what they are is this series of incidents where MF Doom sent other people to perform instead of him out to gigs. And people found out about it because the guys that he was sending out to perform instead of him were just like so off. I mean, there were some guys that were really tall. There were some guys that were really short. There were some that were like super thin, some that were kind of big. Either way, they didn't perform at all like him. And people started to notice, his fans.
We should say that MF Doom always performs with a mask, right?
Right. MF Doom, since 1999, since the release of his album Operation Doomsday, he's performed with a metallic gladiator mask. So you don't really know what he looks like unless you, like, go back in time and look at the old footage of him performing in KMD. But since then, yeah, he's worn the mask, so you don't really know what he looks like. Doom is known for, like, doing a lot of shit-talking at his shows. He's known for crowd work. He's known for riling up his audience and joking with them. And these guys just held the mic close to their mouth, and they didn't move, they didn't talk, they were just stiff as a board, and people, you know, could tell that it wasn't really the real Doom. I used to cop a lot, but never cop no drop. Hold mics like ponytails tight and bobble ops. Stop, stick around, come through and dig the sound of the flop round 606 cycle. Who throws a dick around, bound to go through.
Well, so if I'm MF Doom, wildly talented, pro at crowd work artist, why would I send somebody chubbier and less talented than I am to perform in my concert under my name?
I think it's a combination of a bunch of things, but I also think that he is after, like, kind of performance art, you know? He's sort of, before Kanye came out with the Alejandro Jodorowsky Holy Mountain set pieces on tour, Doom was, like, doing performance art way before that, you know, and just really making a spectacle out of his shows. So I think that he was really placing himself in line with a lot of black performance artists by sending these guys out there as a kind of a commentary on the music industry and fans who feel like they haven't figured out.
So you're drawing a connection between pop music and performance art. And there's a specific group of performance artists that sounds like you're thinking about in particular, right?
Yeah, there are a bunch. So there's, like, first off, the person I thought about was Adrian Piper, the artist Adrian Piper. Back in, like, 1973, she started this series of performances called The Mythic Being. And so Adrian Piper is this really fair-skinned, light-skinned black woman. And she would dress up in an Afro wig and a mustache and, like, sunglasses and, I guess, traditionally or conventionally masculine attire, and go out in the city and ride the bus and interact with people and just sort of watch and observe how people responded to the character that she was playing, this mythic being, right? And then, of course, there's this dude, Ramelzy, who is known to people who, like, watch Jim Jarmusch films and who, like, Basquiat. He did this rap album with Basquiat back in the early 80s, late 70s. And it was called Bebop. And it was just them two, like, kind of freestyling and messing around. Niggas waiting at the station for the big paycheck. Homeboys going baking on Thursday night. Girls waiting in the house for Mr. Right. Kids going to school just to be your fool. Yeah, and so Ramelzy, like, he created these 22 characters. And he designed all their clothing. And sometimes he would just show up in public dressed like these characters he created. And so I place Doom within that lineage. I connect the spots like connect the dots from the lower east side to way up top. I got a map to express on the six. I found where they got the. You can find Nai Lohr's essay on MF Doom as an unreliable songwriter and find out more about black performance art and MF Doom's connection with that lineage in the new issue of The Believer, which is on newsstands now, or you can subscribe by going to believermag.com. This week's episode of The Organist was produced by me, Jenny Amint, and Sophia Steinert-Evoy. The Organist is produced by me and Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge-Weitzkopf. Our intern is the aforementioned Sophia Steinert-Evoy. Special thanks this week to Elizabeth Kulas, as well as Andrea and Alf Gadberry, Emilio Oliveira, and Alyssa Bassist.
SplendidSex.com, SexAin'tBad.com, AbolishSex.com, BoredomWorld.com, WorldwideRebellion.com, AdultMutantNinjaTurtle.com, DinoMouse.com, CrotchLocker.com, SexyMorgue.com, ManicTuba.com, BigScaryDude.com.
Brian McMullen is publishing a special printed zine edition of StillNot.com's to coincide with the release of this episode of The Organist. And he'd like to make this print edition freely available to any Organist listener who emails him mentioning The Organist at brianmcmullen@hotmail.com. I have a feeling that that email address also dates back to the .com boom. As the announcer for The Phil Donahue Show might put it, for a free transcript of the StillNot.com's portion of today's show, send an email with your request to brianmcmullen@hotmail.com.
Fallaciography.com, belchbattle.com, animalcriminals.com, criminalanimal.com.
Also, next week, when we'd normally be taking a week off between episodes, we're going to release our second special appendix episode. This one will feature Brian McMullen reading all 1,000 entries in his collection of StillNot.coms. Please do not operate heavy machinery while listening to that or any appendix episode of The Organist. Finally, if you like this podcast, please give us a rating and a review on the Apple Podcast page. If enough people do this, Apple Podcasts will show The Organist to listeners who would otherwise never find it, and then KCRW will be happy, and then you'll hear more organists. But what does an Apple Podcast review of The Organist even sound like? To help you understand how easy and fun it can be to write a review of The Organist for Apple Podcasts, we've asked the distinguished novelist Fiona Mazel to demonstrate. What's more, we've asked the actor, writer, and director Zoe Lister-Jones to bring Mazel's review to life. Zoe's latest film, Band-Aid, which she wrote, directed, and stars in alongside Fred Armisen and Adam Pally, is on iTunes August 29th. Fiona Mazel's most recent novel is called A Little More Human. Anyway, here's the review, written by Fiona Mazel, performed by Zoe Lister-Jones. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Truth be told, I've never heard of The Organist, and don't even know what a podcast is. I mean, I barely live in the 21st century. You know, my idea of advanced technology is a toilet seat whose trajectory from up to down takes so long to complete I can pluck my unibrow while waiting for it to happen. Who invented the slow-closed toilet? I'm sure the World Wide Web could tell me, but I don't bother with that stuff. And frankly, what can it really do for me? The slow-closed toilet is a stay-against drama. Ever seen a little boy's finger after it's been smashed? An entire hand? Bloodburger City. And the shrieking. I've had four children. How many times did Nathan jam his thumb, swollen, purple, angry, under his armpit, trying not to bawl, but bawling all the same, because Lucy said if she found the seat up one more time, she'd bring evidence of his ejaculate in Bear Bear's mouth to school? Siblings. So mean. And that poor bear. One day you are a lovey that helps your baby fall asleep, and the next day you're receiving his seat in the fur of your gullet. And let's not forget my little Jack, you up there, baby, who loved the sound of the lid smacking against the porcelain so much he had only himself to blame. Even Sadie, my eldest, got her face done in, which was the thing that finally blew the door open on her troubles and made denial a little harder for us all. Poor girl. Bulimia was an open secret in my house, but secret nonetheless. But even a girl, beautiful, lithe, self-hating, like you wouldn't believe, who was expert in concealment, who is resting her cheek on the seat and wondering what it will take to arrest this compulsion, her throat is burning, her acid reflux is out of control, even she cannot stifle a cry when the lid shuts on her face, breaking one maxilla and one nasal bone, which initiates a quest for self-renovation that ends in a Buddhist retreat that cuts her off from everyone who loves her, including her mother. Sadie's been lost to me these past 4 years. Nathan is living in Oregon with his wife, who'd prefer her children not be exposed to the likes of me, and because hers is the expression Nathan must wake up to every day and not mine, whatever so, my boy has conceded his filial obligations to his chosen at the altar. As for Lucy, she just paid for this new Toto toilet with the magic seat because my old one was crap. Well, looky here, I made a joke. And this retirement home is too cheap to mind its own. Lucy lives in Palo Alto, which she keeps saying is so nice and that I should visit, though we both know this won't happen. I think she says these things to feel better about being so far away, given how the rest of the kids have panned out, and I don't blame her for not wanting to shoulder the guilt of my loneliness, my insomnia, and despair that have me sitting here at 4 a.m. on the Toto thinking about what I can do to keep on until morning, which brings with it the chance of a call or a card in the post. So, here it is. My neighbor Alice has a grandson who's 23, and her joy, though he's obviously none too joyous to visit, just sits around with those headphones on. So I asked him today what he was listening to, and he said, The Organist. And I said, Church music? And he said, McSweeney's podcast. And I said, Sounds dirty. And he laughed, which was nice, because sometimes I doubt whether I exist at all. But here was this young man laughing, though I poked him to be sure, and he said, Ow. I told him, I can't sleep. And he said, Perfect. And then he taught me how to press play. And the night passed with a little less grief than usual. 4 stars.